To badquaker.com podcast. Today Kai is back with us in the old studio here, and say hi, Kai.
Hello. Sorry if I sound funny today. I'm battling a cold and allergies,
and it's windy and nasty outside, which makes it even worse. I'm Ben Stone, and this is the badquaker.com podcast. And we're just going to, Kai hasn't been with me for a while, so we're just going to kind of hit a couple headlines and ramble on and kind of see what comes up and what we end up talking about. Over on the Drudge Report, they're making a big deal because Louis Farrakhan says, people will soon kill their leaders, or at least that's the Drudge version of the headline.
Right, which is kind of silly. It's kind of like saying people will soon eat dinner, or people have always killed their leaders. Since there have been leaders, people have killed them. That's kind of what happens.
Yeah, there's even a name for that. What's it called? Regicide.
Regicide, yeah.
Which has nothing to do with Regis, you know, the former talk show host.
The Reg.
Yeah.
I mean, when you make a statement like that, clearly he doesn't know how it's done, because when you make a statement like that, you have to make it with things like, in a city near water rising from phoenix ashes. You got to put some pizzazz into
That's a Nostradamus reference. I get that. Yeah, that was his way of making predictions. You make the prediction so vague that no matter what happens, your prediction will come true. And no matter what happens, you can't be held to your prediction.
Well, I mean, Nostradamus was not even prophesizing. He was making social commentary on the day. Like, it was relevant to what was happening around him at that time. It's like taking political cartoons 40 years from now and being like, oh, look, they predicted. No, they didn't. The same thing is happening now as was happening then.
So you're saying 300 years from now, people are going to be reading Doonesbury going, look, he predicted it. This really happened.
Yeah, exactly.
Let me pull back up Drudge Report and let's see if we can mock anybody else. We took a shot. Oh, I know what it was. I was going to take a shot at Farrakhan because he's beginning to sound more and more irrational and more irrelevant. And I think he's kind of like the black Muslim version of what's that guy's name? Pat Robinson. Pat Robinson, yeah.
Is it Robertson or Robertson?
Robinson. I don't know.
I don't care.
I'm almost glad I don't know.
That's something else that I know. That piece of information doesn't get a chance to push something else relevant out of my brain.
At least to my knowledge, Farrakhan's not claiming that he can leg press 1,500 pounds or whatever it was, or 2,000 pounds or whatever.
That was hysterical. Hysterical.
Oh, my. Here's a headline. A Texas man arrested for urinating on the Alamo. And it's not Ozzy Osbourne.
I was just going to ask that. Is that Ozzy? Is Ozzy in Texas again?
Terrible. Terrible, terrible.
Oh, poor Ozzy. Apparently, he's getting back together with
Black Sabbath.
Black Sabbath. And they're like doing a tour, or at the very least, a gig. Which I think it's hysterical. Not that this has anything at all to do with Bad Quaker or Anarchy or anything, but I think it's personally funny. So Ozzy Osbourne has this Ozfest that he does.
Mm-hmm.
And he started it because he tried to get into Lollapalooza, and Lollapalooza was like, no. Because he doesn't fit with Lollapalooza.
Uh-huh.
At all. So he started Ozfest.
Right.
So now he's back with Black Sabbath, and the only show that they're doing in the United States is at Lollapalooza in Chicago.
You're kidding.
No.
Why is Lollapalooza that desperate for bands that they've gone outside their genre?
I don't know. I don't know if it's that or if they just didn't want Ozzy. Like, they'll take him with Black Sabbath, but just Ozzy. You gotta have something a little more than that for us.
How weird. Oh, well, our listeners are probably not tuning in to hear the old rocker podcast. Right. Tuning in. What about tuning that? Like, in. People tune in on the internet. Like, is that 93.2 or is it 94.3? Even tuning a radio doesn't happen nowadays.
No, you don't. You just hit the seek button and it goes to the next one.
So it's... Ah, there's Nikki.
Nikki says, this conversation is boring.
So now you were attacking Sikhs, is that right? So you prefer what, Muslims or Hindus? Or what were you saying about Sikhs?
Yes. No. What?
Actually, I kind of appreciate the Sikh, at least the culture. I don't know that much about them religiously.
Right.
But the Sikh, part of their religiously, they have to wear a ceremonial dagger.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's kind of cool. I think people should all carry daggers. I'm pro dagger. I'm very pro dagger. I saw. Oh, I know what it was. The other day, you and Matt or somebody were talking about the discussion was about chopsticks and forks and so forth.
Oh yeah, because I was eating Indian food with my fingers.
Yeah. And right about the same time, somebody said something about, it may have been on the Food Network a few minutes later that I heard someone say that, oh, I know what it was, Elton Brown.
Elton.
Yeah. plays the piano, wears the big glasses.
Yes, and the Donald Duck costume.
Yeah. Anyway, he was talking about using a knife, mm-hmm. and the reason he prefers to use kitchen shears is because most people learn how to use scissors in kindergarten,
mm-hmm.
and you don't learn to use a knife until much later. And I was thinking about that at the same time that you guys were talking about utensils and so forth. And I thought, well, that's odd. I was carrying my first pocket knife long before I was in kindergarten. I learned how to use a pocket knife before I learned how to use scissors.
Yeah.
But I don't know, maybe.
Maybe. Are you saying that you fall outside the realm of normal? Are you saying your upbringing wasn't exactly
traditional?
On par with tradition? Because I don't know about you, but I had a totally normal upbringing.
Normal.
Completely normal.
You know, we've got a lot of new listeners since we've talked about that kind of stuff, so that might be a good thing to touch on today. Actually, I should probably make a little bit better introduction, because since we do have new listeners,
I haven't been on here. I haven't been on the podcast for a while.
Yeah.
So I've probably got a lot of people who are like, who is this woman?
So Kai is my daughter, and we are together, the only father-daughter anarchist podcast team on the internet/radio.
That we know of.
That we know of. Today.
At this moment.
Your mileage may vary. So, and speaking of mileage may vary, you're thinking of buying a vehicle.
I am.
Been looking around at the different kinds of things available out there on the market. You're going to go with a green, like a battery operated, spend $60,000 and be trendy and feel good about saving the world?
No. No, we actually did the math on that at one point. And not factoring in how much electricity costs.
Mm-hmm.
Because, honestly, if you live in the United States and you're using electricity, you're probably either using a coal-based electricity or a petroleum-based electricity.
Yeah.
That's just kind of how it works in this country.
Yep.
I can't speak for other countries, but here, that's how it works. So not factoring the cost of actual electricity to run the vehicle, I think we figured out that you would have to drive it for like 15 years or something like that before you saved any money on the gas based on how much you would spend.
But now the greenies and the environmentalists and all those people say it's not about the spending money, it's about saving the universe. But of course they don't consider like where the rare earth minerals had to be dug out of Central Africa at the point of a gun and then hauled away to China where practical slave labor made them into batteries and then shipped them over here, and all the pollution that resulted in having to haul you know, these minerals from Central Africa to Asia and then from Asia back to North America and then sell them to environmentalists so they can feel good about themselves.
Yeah, there's an episode of South Park where one of the kids, I know you don't watch South Park.
I don't watch South Park.
It's hysterical. You should. I pass judgment on you for not watching South Park. But one of the kids' dads gets a green smart car, whatever, and it starts flooding the town with smug. Yeah, no, I'm not intending on getting anything like that. I want something that I can put high mileage on and I can tow something with. And
Utilitarian.
Something that if need be, I can put all of my belongings in and drive across country. Not that I would ever need to do that, because, you know, I've never needed to do that.
Right.
Oh, wait. I've needed to do that, like, nearly
every couple years. Yeah, that's what we were referring to a second ago. All the time that my wife and I have three children. Our oldest is Brian, our son, and then we have two daughters. All three are adults, and all three are, you know, we're very proud of them, and they've done wonderful accomplishments, and et cetera, and et cetera, and et cetera.
I've made accomplishments?
All the typical bragging that a parent would do, insert here. But as the kids were growing up, we offered them anything but a normal life. We did everything from private school to homeschool to no school to anti-school to public school to, you know, around in circles and everything in between. And, you know, not necessarily homeless, but camping in the wild for months and months at a time.
It's camping. We're not homeless. We have a truck.
Escaping one state very quickly before they realize that you've switched all the license plates on all the vehicles and you're just trying to get out of Dodge as quick as possible. And other adventures like that. But, and, you know, living on what we captured, gigged, caught, and so forth.
Which is always fun when you've got little kids, you know, tagging along.
Yeah, yeah. And the one trip that we made across country, we left California in somewhat of a hurry. Although we did have a little bit of time to prepare for that move. We were in two pickup trucks, one with a camper that didn't fit it. And the other pickup truck had a bunch of our belongings in the back of the truck and then an extra truck bed turned upside down on top of that truck bed, so that once we got the entire vehicle back to Ohio, we could scrap both pieces out and sell them independently and pay for our trip. And then on the top of that pickup truck with the upside down turned bed on the bed of the truck, we had probably about 24 tires and wheels strapped down with ropes. Do you recall that?
No. I remember the camper. I don't remember the other truck.
Yeah, it was something else to look at. It was very Grapes of Wrath.
A rocking chair on top with Granny and her shotgun.
We pulled into the Painted Desert, into the visitors area of the Painted Desert, and parked both the trucks, and we got out and we took the van tour or the bus tour that they have where you get in it, and it's like a upper deck thing that's open deck on top. It's like an upper and lower deck thing. And so we were up on the top deck with the tour guide, and he's talking through his little microphone, and we go out and drive around through the Painted Desert and look at all the amazing stuff and rocks and things.
Oh, look, it's a rock. Oh, look, another rock.
But it's colorful. Anyway, we come back to the visitor's center parking lot, and there are our two pickup trucks sitting there, one with a mismatched camper that doesn't fit the truck, and parked directly behind that is the truck with a truck bed turned upside down on top of the bed, and all these tires and wheels strapped to the top of it. And the tour guide kind of pauses, this awkward pause, and as he almost says something, and then I go, "Yeah, I know, that's us. We know what it looks like." the whole tour bus sort of broke into laughter. It was no fun. But you got to do what you got to do.
We were really little at that time.
Yeah, you guys were pretty small. Hannah was the youngest, was probably less than a year, I'm thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah, probably less than a year.
No, it couldn't have been less than a year because...
No, you're right. She was about a year and a half because it was the summer after she turned a year.
Yeah.
So like a year and a half.
Yeah.
And
because I had gone through kindergarten at the private school.
Yeah, that's right.
In California.
Yeah. And but we, you know, it was important for us to get out of California. It was important to get out now. And it was important to be as independent as possible and not depend on anybody or anything or any systems or anything else to do what we need to do.
And that's important. I mean, the idea of, you know, nobody wants to be cast out as a social misfit or whatever. But at the same time, you have to take care of yourself and your family and your personal belongings. And it's not about whether or not you're fitting into this social norm. It's about deciding that you're going to take charge of yourself and be independent, you know?
Getting back to the news over here, I was very disturbed to read the headline that this headline says, "Taliban attacks U.S. embassy government sites across Afghanistan." And the specific reason that struck me is because I have a friend who, and this may sound strange coming from an anarchist who's against the war and who's all these kind of things, but I have a friend who is a very solid libertarian and is somewhere between a minarchist and an anarchist, but is stuck in his duties in the U.S. Army because he's already been in for so long.
Right.
And he's sort of stuck with this, and he had hoped that he would be out of the line of fire, so to speak, for the very short remainder of his career. And now he's stuck headed right back into Kabul. And that's where this is happening. There's a huge offensive. The Taliban is attacking targets in Kabul, which the Afghan capital.
Mm-hmm.
And I had made comments on Facebook not long ago about Kabul that most Americans have no idea what it was like there in the 60s.
Right.
You know, if you listen to the Led Zeppelin song Kashmir, the point of that song, which probably escapes almost everybody nowadays, but the point of that song, or at least one of the points, because there were several messages that were embedded into the song, but one of the points of the song is a journey that was very common for hikers, especially sort of the drug-related hikers, if we can put it that way, was to hike from Kabul, which is in central Afghanistan, up into the mountains and across the old one of the old Silk Routes into Kashmir and eventually to Kathmandu in Nepal.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was a journey. This was a journey of awakening and a journey of maturity for a person to take. And it's not an easy journey because the distance is pretty amazing.
Right.
And also you're going from a fairly low elevation to an amazingly high elevation.
Right.
And
it's not exactly like there are REI outlets on the way.
Right,
you know?
Right. This was, and these people, a lot of Americans, but a lot of Europeans as well, did this as an awakening journey in their early 20s and so forth, and they were totally safe. You could, back in those days, you could catch a flight, because Kabul was an up-and-coming, very modernizing city, and you could catch a flight from pretty much anywhere in Europe, fly into Afghanistan, land in Kabul, and you were treated you know, like if you were a guest,
right?
In every by every single Afghan that saw you,
right?
It was an honor for them to invite you into their home and to feed you and to help you on your journey,
right?
And this was the same all the way across Afghanistan, all the way over the mountains into Kashmir, across the massive Kashmir. Is this wide region that's a somewhat of a almost like a big giant bowl in the western Himalayas, and then up the other side of the mountains into Nepal and to Kathmandu.
Right,
and that was considered. It wasn't common, but a lot of people did it.
Mm-hmm.
And Afghanistan was an extremely hospitable place. With extreme levels of kindness and what changed all that? Well, the CIA figured out that there was a lot of poppies being grown there, and
poppies,
a lot of
poppies.
And in the 70s, you know, I don't think very many people question it anymore. I think the evidence is abundant enough to where no one even tries to hide this. Through most of the 60s and well up into the 70s, the CIA obtained quite a bit of funding through the heroin market, specifically in the growing of poppies in Southeast Asia.
What? The CIA making money off drugs? No way!
They had big operations in Cambodia, in Laos, in Thailand. And when Cambodia, as the Vietnam War deteriorated and the whole region became more and more unstable, the CIA suffered tremendously because they didn't have the freedom to move around their products, their drug products, the way that they had in the past. And, you know, as the United States policies failed horribly in Southeast Asia, the CIA was forced to evacuate the area just like the rest of the United States forces
right.
did. And in doing so, they lost all their major funding from Southeast Asia from the drug trade. And so by the mid to late 70s, the CIA was desperate for funding. And Afghanistan became a very convenient target for the CIA.
Well, because... the Soviet Union had been eyeing Afghanistan for quite some time.
Well, for a number of reasons. If you look on a map, especially if you get an older map that actually shows the Soviet Union,
right?
They didn't have a warm southern port. The Soviet Union had ports in the Black Sea that gave them a warm water port, but they were entirely dependent on the Suez Canal
right.
To get to Southeast Asia and to get to pretty much, well, two things. If you with your warm water ports in the Black Sea, you're dependent on two huge bottlenecks to try to get your ships anywhere.
Right.
One being the Suez Canal, which is a nasty bottleneck, and the other being what's it called? Gibraltar, the Straits of Gibraltar, which is a nasty bottleneck that's controlled by England and
right.
by proxy, that means the U.S. So the Soviet Union would have loved to have had a way to get to a warm water port. And to do that, Afghanistan and Iran and Pakistan would have made a nice pathway for the Soviet Union. But
would have been a nice addition to their wall.
Yeah. And then in addition to that, if they could have controlled Afghanistan, they would have had access to oil lines that could have come up through Iran and Pakistan and helped support the Soviet Union in that way as well. And at the same time, China would have loved to have had oil lines through Afghanistan to supply oil, you know, without going over ocean, because if you're going through the oceans with transporting oil, then you're susceptible to the strength of the U.S. So for all these reasons, the Soviet Union had a desire to have control, or at least influence, in Afghanistan.
Right.
And then, in addition to that, the CIA began moving in the late 70s and destabilizing, because, you know, if the CIA moves in, they're bringing money with them, they're essentially they're subsidizing crops.
Right.
Which, you know, the poppy crops and the hashish. So as they start to subsidize these crops, that throws off the balance, the natural balance of the market that was in Afghanistan.
Which messes up the economy entirely.
Yeah, which again, more destabilization. And, you know, the CIA is like any other parasitical organization. They can't, they're just like the mafia. They can't move into an area and not bring their influence and control in as well.
Well, and plus, instead of having a situation where there are many different group leaders who are all guerrilla warfaring against the Soviet Union to keep the Soviet Union out, the CIA comes in and picks one.
Yeah.
And says, we're gonna favor you. We're going to give you lots of money.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to give you lots of weapons. And we're going to give you training. And you're our little puppet now.
And all of this upsets the all of the natural balance, not only of the economy, but of the local governments and tribal governments and everything.
Which was a balance that had been there
for
thousands of years.
Going all the way back to till prehistory, because
Afghanistan has never been conquered.
Yeah, there have been chunks taken of it at times. The English took a pretty good chunk in the 1800s. They couldn't hold it.
Yeah,
you know, Alexander the Great very famously crashed upon its mountains and couldn't stay. The Mongols attempted numerous times and probably had the best luck of anyone. But the reason the Mongols had the best luck, they didn't necessarily want to manage the entire country. They were more interested in a network of, you know, small taxation to the local existing warlords.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, as long as you pay the tributary, the tribute, then everybody's fine.
Right.
So they probably had the best luck because they didn't actually come in and try to manage the country.
Right.
But pretty much nobody has been able to really conquer Afghanistan. So here's the CIA in there in the late 70s using it as a cash cow.
Mm-hmm.
And this made the Soviet Union very uncomfortable. And at some point in time, the CIA figured out that they could bait the Soviet Union into attacking the enemy that can't be conquered.
Right.
Knowing that this would cost tremendously, it would be a huge taxing upon the Soviet Union's empire. So the CIA began baiting them into Afghanistan. But in the process, let's see, where was I going with all that to start with? Well, that pretty much ruined Afghanistan as a place where people could go and find peace and freedom and security and move from town to town just by the hospitality of the locals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all that was destroyed because the locals figured out that people in the West were nasty creatures.
Right.
And they didn't like us anymore.
Right.
You know, because of what the CIA had done in there. And then, you know, eventually...
Which I can't blame them. I wouldn't like us either.
Yeah. You think about this from a different angle. If, for instance, if China were to move troops into Canada, or even just a spy network in Canada that began destabilizing the Canadian government,
mm-hmm.
how would people in the U.S. feel about that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then if the spy network in Canada began to destabilize, say, upstate New York
mm-hmm.
and the major cities in Ohio that are along the Great Lakes and Michigan and, you know, Chicago and so forth, what would people in the U.S. start to think about China
mm-hmm.
and Canada for doing this?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it irritates them. But we don't think about that when the United States does that to some country. We think, you know, how dare they get mm-hmm. mad at us or whatever. So we're going to break for a commercial and we'll be right back. Stick with us and we'll be right back in 2 minutes. How would you like to support BadQuaker.com and get something nice for yourself at the same time? I want to tell you about Survival Gear Bags. It's run by my friend Kelly, who believes in and adheres to the non-aggression principle. Kelly's customers know him for his great customer service and his personal touch, because Kelly handles all customer service himself. The main focus of Survival Gear Bags is to allow you to build your own custom emergency kits with quality gear. Now, I know this because I bought my bug out bag from Survival Gear Bags over 2 years ago, and I've gone all over the country with it by my side. And you can rest assured that the prices will always be the best they can be at Survival Gear Bags. And if you use the link from badquaker.com, they'll probably throw in something for free for you with your order. Now, how do you do this? Well, it's simple. You go to badquaker.com. On the right side of the page, click on the picture of the backpack. Then look around at Survival Gear Bags and find the stuff you want. You'll help badquaker.com and you'll support a merchant that's one of us. Now, I want to tell you about another way you can support BadQuaker.com and get something really cool at the same time. Shire Silver. Shire Silver is the proud seller of silver and gold trade cards. Shire Silver believes that silver and gold trade cards will show the world a better way to save, spend, and share precious metals. So what are silver and gold trade cards? They're specific weights of gold and silver laminated inside credit card-sized tradable cards. They're a handy and affordable way to trade precious metals. These cards received nationwide recognition when they were widely used as barter at the New Hampshire Porcupine Festival. You want a beer and a hot dog? Hand them a Shire Silver 5 card and get a Shire Silver 1 spot back as change. So again, what do? Well, you go to BadQuaker.com. On the right side, just below the backpack, you'll see the Shire Silver trade cards. Click on those cards and then check out Shire Silver's site. Be sure and watch Ron's video that's right there on the main page. And then swap some of those ridiculous Federal Reserve notes for something of real value. Something you can keep, trade, or give as the coolest gift ever. But be sure and use the link from BadQuaker.com. Thanks, folks. Well, thanks for sticking with us through the commercial, and we're back now. Now, that wasn't so painful sitting through that commercial, now was it? talking about Afghanistan, and the reason that I had brought that up is because I have this friend who is literally on his way. The last time I spoke with him on the internet, he was in Kuwait on his way to Afghanistan, mm-hmm. and he's going to be stationed right there in Kuwait, in Kabul. And that doesn't make me happy at all. I had really hoped that the region would stay stable during the time that he's there, so that he could come home to his family safely. And you know, and I had really hoped that that would be the case. And it looks like he's going to be walking right into a hornet's nest when he gets there.
Right.
And I really feel sorry for him. And I, you know, a lot of people in the liberty movement, and specifically anarchists like ourselves, have very little compassion for some of these soldiers, because it's like, well, what are they doing in there anyway?
Right.
And I understand that, but at the same time, you know, so often a person commits to something before they've really learned all about liberty, mm-hmm. and then your choices of trying to get out of it are very limited.
Or it was the only choice that was really an option.
Yeah.
You know, because they make the military look so appealing, especially to specific demographics, that, mm-hmm. you know, your options are basically military or jail.
Yeah. Or drug dealing. Because especially for, which, like, inner city.
I think it's hysterical, because in Afghanistan, one of the main jobs of the military is to guard opium fields. So your options are drugs or drugs.
Yeah, one side of the drug war or the other.
Yeah.
it's both on the same side of the drug war.
You can
war.
Deal heroin on the streets, or you can protect opium poppy fields in Afghanistan.
A lot of people don't realize the level of involvement that the U.S. government has been on both sides of the drug war, the so-called drug war, mm-hmm. right from the beginning. You know, when at first Nixon invented this drug war, and, you know, Elvis came to the White House, and they really got things kicked off to try to stop stop kids from using the drugs, and that worked well.
Right.
And then Elvis OD'd.
And then no one used drugs again.
Just a shot at Nixon. It's easy to think, especially from my generation that actually remembers him, it's easy to think that he was some kind of criminal mastermind running the White House and doing all these evil things.
No, he was an idiot, like all other politicians.
Yeah, he was. He was really a buffoon. You know, he was. People make fun, back in those days, people made fun of Gerald Ford, who took over, mm-hmm. because he seemed like such a buffoon.
Right.
But, I mean, they were all buffoons. If you listen to the White House recordings of Lyndon Johnson from the 1960s, that guy was an idiot.
Yeah.
I mean, he was, you know, he was really not that bright.
Well, of course not. They're not going to allow someone with half a brain to be president. That's too dangerous.
Anyway, ragging on the CIA in the late 70s there, I have some firsthand experience with with those people. That was in the time frame when, now I wasn't doing anything of any significance with, like, with heroin or anything like that, because right. I always thought that was pretty nasty stuff. So I tried to avoid all of that kind of market as much as possible.
Plus, those are really nasty people.
Yeah, and the worst types of drugs have a tendency to attract the worst types of violence. So mm-hmm. We try, you know, if you can make a living without that,
right.
why go into that area? But I was involved in some situations where we went down into Southern California, and there was purchases of large bricks of hashish. And this was all Afghan.
Like you do.
Yeah, like you do. You know, it's the 70s. Hey, what else you got to do? It's either that or listen to disco, and nobody wants to do that.
So I can go listen to YMCA or
some Afghan hash. Let's go get some hash.
I'm thinking Afghanistan hash. Yeah, let's do it.
The first time that I went down to Southern California to get some hash, I was very uncomfortable with the situation. And the way the operation took place is multiple people would be in the car going down, you know, to pick it up.
Right.
And typically what would happen is when we got to the house where this exchange took place, they would be waiting and paying attention, and the guy would open the garage door, and we would pull the car into the garage.
Mm-hmm.
And you would think that they would have a garage door opener, but they didn't. They had a guy that stood there and opened and closed the garage. My parents at the time had a garage door opener, you know. But these guys are dealing massive quantities of Afghan hashish, and they had a guy who stood there and opened the garage door. Anyway, so you pull the car into the garage, which, from a drug dealer's point of view, this makes you feel really vulnerable.
Right.
You would prefer to have the car sitting a house or two away, or even having multiple cars, one at the house and one back a little bit with some armed friends.
Right.
You know? But you have to do what you have to do.
Right.
You know, you have to follow the rules in these things. And that was the rules.
Right.
So, so we pull the car into the garage. Everybody stays in the car except the one person who has been there before and knows the people.
Right.
He gets out, goes in, makes the purchase, comes out, sticks everything in the trunk, and then we leave. And the thing that struck me at the time was the over-friendliness of the garage door opener dude.
Mm-hmm.
He was not he didn't look like us at
right.
all. And when I say that, I mean, we were long hair, shorts, short cutoff pants, Levi's, flip flops, no shirt, tanned, very, very dark, and a lot of blonde hair, you know,
right.
except Tony had like black, pitch black hair. But other than that, you know, we looked like Southern California surfer dudes, just like everybody else did
right.
at the time. These guys were like, you know, mid-40s, late-30s, mid-40s, polo shirt or golf shirt. Was it,
yeah, polo was it? Shirt.
Yeah, with the collar and like three buttons or whatever. Uh-huh. Buttoned. and slacks and polished shoes, shiny polished shoes. It was like, who wears those things, you know? This guy is standing, opening and closing the garage door of a drug house. And he's dressed like he just came off the golf links or something. It was so weird. And so I asked the guy that actually went in the house, among our group, was Tony.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm asking Tony, I'm like, so what is it with these guys? And Tony's like, well, I think they're gay, you know, because it's all guys living in the house.
Mm-hmm.
There's like four or five of them in there. And you know, there's no females at all. Well, we were used to like biker houses
mm-hmm.
and safe houses and stuff like this. And there would always be four or five guys and three or four girls or
right.
four or five girls and two or three guys or whatever. And it was always, you know,
mixed.
Yeah, yeah. Gender friendly. So finding this house in the suburbs, an upscale for its day, an upscale house in the suburbs in Southern California being used as a drug house with all guys, all extremely clean cut, short hair, all wearing this similar weird, you know, to us weird outfits. So Tony's like, yeah, they must be gay.
Right.
In our next trip down, it turns out that the assumption that they were gay was not correct because there were all kinds of Playboys scattered all over the coffee tables.
Right.
And so that theory started to melt away. Plus, I can't remember if it was the first trip or this. I think it was the first trip that Tony mentioned that there were weird voices coming from the other room. It's kind of like it was on the radio or something, but it wasn't really, it didn't sound like radio. It sounded like chatter, like talk,
mm-hmm.
like people would be talking. And it sounded like it was coming from a radio,
mm-hmm.
but it didn't sound like radio chatter. Mm-hmm. It sounded like people talking.
Mm-hmm.
And so as we started to put these things together over later visits to the same house, picking up more and more Afghan hashish, we figured out that these guys had some type of bugging device in there. They were listening to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
They were, you know, they had some kind of recording device in there, and they were listening to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And we figured out slowly but surely, we figured out that they were CIA.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the thing that really tipped us off was because, you know, we could buy, like, for instance, I think we went over the numbers on this before.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Mexican marijuana was selling, well, you could buy it for like $400 or $500 a pound, or no, $200 to $300 a pound, I think, for Mexican pot at the time, and Colombian pot was selling for $400 to $500 a pound, and so we could get a couple keys of hash, which was the equivalent of a lot of pot.
Right.
You know, we could get that cheaper than we could get, you know, pounds of pot.
Right, and you don't have to carry around pounds of pot.
Yeah, yeah. So really, it was, you know, it was a killer price.
Right.
And it was all wrapped in this weird, very colorful cellophane type, almost a foil type mm-hmm. wrappers. And it really struck me odd because I'd never seen anything wrapped in wrappers like that.
Mm-hmm.
You see stuff like that nowadays in like Chinese markets or in Asian markets.
Right.
But at the time in the late 70s, I had never seen anything wrapped in that type of a cellophane wrapper. And all of it was wrapped in that, wrapped very tightly with, you know, strange emblems to us,
right.
which were the symbols of the Mujahideen and the crescent moon with the star and
right.
so forth. So basically, what we were looking at from an economic point of view was that the pot coming out of Mexico was essentially your typical black market product.
Right, unsubsidized.
Yeah, and the pot coming out of Colombia was your typical black market product. Again, unsubsidized, higher quality, little harder to get a hold of, had to go a further distance, more risks, a little
right.
bit more expensive.
Right.
Local pot in California was dirt cheap. You could almost, it was almost a giveaway item.
Right.
Local grown pot in California was considered, you know, I mean, literally, you couldn't give it away at times.
Right.
So it almost had no value. But in comes this hash, really quality product,
mm-hmm.
priced way underneath the market value, and in supplies of practically unlimited quantities. So from an economics point of view, what we're looking at is government subsidies.
Right.
Driving out the natural parts of the market and bringing in something that was unnatural to the market.
Which is, you know, from the perspective of, I want there to be less harm done by drugs.
Mm-hmm.
That's a terrible thing because now you're taking somebody who would have been dealing in pot
mm-hmm.
and you're going, oh, you're going to make way more money if you deal in hash.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. And we, I shouldn't say we, for me personally, I stopped because it was just destroying my throat.
Yeah.
You know, you in order to sell it, you also have to partake in it.
Right.
And it was really rough to try. I'm sure if you did it correctly, like like they do in Afghanistan, which is, you know, you get a hookah.
Right.
And which is a large water pipe, essentially. And right. you smoke it very slowly through the water filtration.
Right.
That lowers the temperature and everything like that. But we weren't doing that. We were doing stuff like you take a milk jug and you cut it in half so that you cut the bottom half of the milk jug off.
Mm-hmm.
You turn it upside down so it's a funnel.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't turn it upside down. You leave it with the narrow point to the top.
Mm-hmm.
And you take two knives and you get them over the stove. You get those two knives literally red hot. And then you smash a wad of hashish between those two knives,
mm-hmm.
and it instantly vaporizes it, and you use that milk jug as a funnel so that you capture all of the smoke that comes off of it, and that's the way that we sold it.
Right.
You know, which if you're accustomed to being relaxed and slowly smoking a joint of marijuana on the beach, and then you hot knife hash, it pretty much blows the back of your head off,
right?
from a high point of view, you know.
A disclaimer: BadQuaker.com does not endorse the use of illegal or illicit products.
Drugs are bad.
Drugs are bad, okay? you shouldn't do drugs. But if you're gonna do drugs, do them properly and don't like redneck together some.
Yeah, but. You know, in selling the product, that was a great selling point.
Mm-hmm.
Regular users of hash would know not to do that all the
right.
time because it destroys your throat. But so a regular user of hash would have used a water pipe and, mm-hmm. and done it in civil, in a civilized fashion. But if we're selling it and we're selling it to new markets who've never even seen hash before,
right?
Because it really wasn't when it first burst on the market. A lot of people. Customers had literally never seen it before.
Mm-hmm.
So we're bringing it in. We're showing them how to do it as hard and fast as possible to as a sale point.
Right.
And so for that reason, we had to eventually stop. I think among our group, I was probably one of the first ones that wimped out
yeah.
and just said, my voice can't, my throat can't take this anymore because I was hoarse, couldn't talk all the time.
Right. And that's not a good selling point.
Yeah. Hey, you really need this.
Yeah. It's not exactly, I don't think so, buddy. I don't think so.
You're 18 and you sound like you've got emphysema. Right? I don't think I want your product.
I think I'm going to stick with the pot. Thanks.
Not
that pot doesn't do the same exact thing.
Well, yeah, probably, because it still burns at a very high temperature.
Yeah.
And
it burns at a higher temperature than cigarettes do.
Yeah, that's one of the most harmful things about marijuana is the high temperature that it burns at.
Yeah.
Anyway, I don't know.
And it destroys your immune system.
Pot does?
Yeah.
Hmm.
Like, I've never known a pothead who wasn't constantly sick.
Hmm.
Like, cold, flu, achy, tired, run down, joints hurt. And then they're like, oh, my joints hurt. I need medicine. I take my natural medicine to make my... Dude, your joints hurt because you're inhaling inflammatory things that are making your body go into overload and attack your joints. Maybe you should stop. Have you tried stopping...
And this is a good point to make that we're really not trying to glamorize drugs or say that they're good or you should do them or anything else.
No, but here's the thing, like, people are going to do what people are going to do. The market
right.
is going to do what the market wants to do. And the best way to encourage responsible behavior
mm-hmm.
is to allow the market to encourage responsible behavior.
Yeah. Yeah.
And not try to interfere and not try to socially plan things mm-hmm. and just allow the market to do what the market is going to do, because there are built-in checks and balances that you can't foresee.
Right.
You know, and if you start messing with one little bit of it, you have no idea what the ripples are going to be for that.
And I think that's really the best point that we can make here, because I don't think anybody could have possibly foreseen, much less planned, in like the late 60s, no one could have seen that, hey, the whole Southeast Asia heroin market is going to fall apart because the U.S. government can't maintain its silly war in Vietnam.
Right.
So we're going to need to move into Afghanistan and start to destabilize there. I doubt that anybody was bright enough to really think these things through and say, you know, then that's going to cause the Soviet Union to want to get involved in Afghanistan, and that's going to break down the Soviet Union's ability to maintain its empire. And, you know, and then we're going to have to radicalize, because a lot of people don't know that in the 1990s, the CIA, well, through the 80s, but even well up into the 90s, the CIA was still distributing material, religious material, religious tracts, with the intent of radicalizing the Muslims in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
Tracts that now, if you're found in possession of these same CIA-printed tracts in Afghanistan, you're considered a terrorist because it's radical material.
Right.
And yet the CIA printed them and the CIA distributed them.
Right. Which I think is an interesting point to make, because Afghanistan never invaded anybody.
Right. Not only that, the 9/11, 9/11, 9/11, 9/11, 9/11. Yeah, except none of the attackers on 9/11 were Afghanis.
Right.
They were all Saudis and Egyptians.
Right.
Ta-da.
Yeah. And all of the horrible Taliban people that are in charge in Afghanistan, we put into place.
Well, I didn't.
Well, I didn't either. But well, the CIA.
In a sense, yeah, my funding helped in the early in the late 70s. But that was the CIA that installed them.
Mm-hmm.
They radicalized them with their own CIA material. The CIA supporting radical Aymans and so forth to get them into power.
Yep.
And then they got out of control and hated us. Wow, shocker.
Really? If you feed your kids sugar all day and then they're going to have a temper tantrum and say they hate you. Wow, I'm shocked.
Well, and that's a good comparison. You feed your kids junk food and beat them every now and then randomly for no particular reason. And then you're surprised when they grow up to hate you.
Yeah.
You know, wow, how did that happen?
Right?
And yet, you know, we're told they hate us because of our freedom, even though our freedom's disappearing pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And most of those people in Afghanistan have no idea what goes on in the United States and haven't throughout time.
And, you know, they can have chickens in their backyard. I can't have chickens in my backyard.
So they're more free in Afghanistan than here.
They can milk a cow and sell the cow's milk at a local farm stand thing.
Mm-hmm.
I can't do that.
Oh, I should mention that, too. I have a different friend who's in Afghanistan right now. And
you don't really have these friends, do you?
Yeah.
These are just friends. You can't see my hands, but I'm making air quotes.
Yeah, no, people who've known me long term know exactly the individuals I'm talking about. But one is private security, has been in Afghanistan for quite some time and is in there right now. And he likes to take pictures of the good pictures, not, you know, nasty, bloody pictures and that kind of thing. He really appreciates the culture and the people there, and he likes to take pictures of things like the countryside and markets and things like this. And he posted on his Facebook a picture of a market with all kinds of products out and everything like this. And it's a big market, especially for there. It might be considered like a strip mall.
Right.
So in this marketplace, one of the markets that's in there is a meat market.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a pretty good-sized meat market. It could be compared to, you know, a good-sized meat market in any town in the U.S.
Right.
Except, you know, there's no front on the building. It's all open on the front.
Right.
And then at night, they just bring in all the product and close down the big, almost like garage doors.
Right.
I'll bet they don't have garage door openers. but during the daytime, they take all the products out of their store and they hang them up in the front so that people walking by can see them.
Right.
So there are, like, you know, quartered cattle, quartered beef hanging there. There are whole sheep slaughtered and treated mm-hmm. and hanging there. There are whole ducks and whole chickens and all these kind of things like you would see in that kind of a market.
Right.
And all kinds of products. I mean, lots and lots of products out laying out there for people who were walking by to be tempted to buy them.
Probably not a whole lot of like ground beef or meat.
I didn't see anything like that at all. And of course, no pork products.
Right, you know? Obviously. Because the thing is, like with meat, as long as the meat is whole,
mm-hmm.
like a whole cut,
mm-hmm.
it stays fresh pretty long.
Yeah, and especially if you just do some smoking and salting, mm-hmm. and you know, it's the old ways of preserving are actually pretty good.
Right.
So anyway, so this friend of mine posts this picture of this market on Facebook. And immediately, you know, all the people in North America who are on his Facebook, they're all like, oh, look, it's botulism. Oh, they're barbarians. Oh, look, you know. And this happened right in the time, you remember a few weeks back when pink slime was in the news?
Oh, yeah.
It was right at the height of that. And I'm like, hey, how come there's no pink slime? I don't see any USDA 100% beef hot dogs with 10% non-meat filler. How do they live without the FDA approving all their food? Well, and of course, the obvious thing is that their food is not unsafe.
Right.
It's very safe. Traditional methods are safe.
Because if it were unsafe, people wouldn't buy from them and they would go out of business.
Yeah, exactly.
If you go to a restaurant and it gives you food poisoning, you mm-hmm. don't go back to that restaurant again.
Unless you're dumb.
And you tell your friends not to go back to that restaurant. And, like, there are checks and balances built into this system.
Mm-hmm.
But if the food inspector comes
mm-hmm.
and says, oh, you pass, we inspected and you passed, and then you get sick,
mm-hmm.
you have no recourse because... Yep. They're up to standard. They're up to code.
Yeah, they're doing everything legal that they have to do.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that false security that comes with a very poorly run government agency, or even the best run
right.
government agencies are still, you know, horrible at what they do. So the false security that comes with believing that this agency can actually ensure safe food.
Right.
And yet, year after year, they become more and more incompetent.
Right. And you want to talk about, like, oh, E. coli, go look at our grocery stores.
Yeah.
Because Afghanistan is not the ones having millions of people infected by foodborne illnesses every year. We are.
Yeah, they can eat the raw spinach there.
Yeah.
And that's the funny thing. You absolutely, if you walked into an American grocery store, a top line brand name grocery store, respected nationwide, and walk in and open up a package of chicken and lick it.
Yeah.
You can expect to die.
Yeah.
Or at least get really, really sick and think you're going to die.
Right. But, well, wish you would die.
Yeah. Pray to die. But you could do that same thing in that outdoor market in Afghanistan, mm-hmm. walk up, take a chicken hanging right on the beam right there. Just take the chicken off its hook and eat it, and you would be perfectly fine.
Right.
How do you know that? Because that's what they do.
Right. Well, and the other thing is that because they don't wipe down everything with Clorox sanitizing wipes, they actually have this...
Or spray ammonia all over everything.
They have this thing called an immune system.
Yeah.
It's this really awesome thing that some humans have where there are bacteria that live in your body.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's this symbiotic relationship that allows you to not get sick. I know, it's a weird concept, but it totally works. And we have completely, you know, adapted to have this system in place.
Wait, what? You mean 10,000 years ago there was no FDA?
Right? How on earth did people live?
Well, we've pretty much milked out our topic as much as we could. Milked out milk, raw milk, haha. Beat an Amish man. Nothing like whipping on an Amish. He's got raw milk.
Get him quick.
So, Bill, what did you do today with the DEA? Shot down the five Amish for selling milk.
Good job.
Try to get 7 tomorrow.
Yeah.
Gotta hit that quota.
Right.
Okay, folks, thanks very much for listening to BadQuaker.com. And remember, for more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. Thanks a lot, folks.